You're a very nosy fella, kitty cat, huh?
You know what happens to nosy fellas?
Huh? No? Wanna guess? Huh? No?
If it's all dealt for them by the filmmakers, they just forget about it over dinner, and that's it. As I was a kid when I saw Mice and Men. Mm-hmm. I remember I loved the film, and it stayed with me for so long, and I felt so sorry for that Lenny. And I thought, what a pity that Lenny couldn't be saved. And then I realized if Lenny was saved, I would forget about this movie.
In Toronto, Canada, I'm the Mad Hatter.
And from London, it is Simon Colin.
Simon, I must tell you, I was concerned, I was dismayed. I know that the cost of Blu-rays in London are very, very high, but that's just no reason to loot the stores.
I know. Unfortunately, I wasn't at home at the time. I was on holiday, so I'm quite lucky. But no, it wasn't. One of the riots in Clapham Junction weren't far away, actually, from our house. But no, nothing actually affected us in the end.
So your neighborhood and everything is okay.
My neighborhood is okay.
There was no damage done to your local boots.
No, the neighborhood about 10, 15 minutes down the road in both directions, in Clapham Junction, in Brixton, they have both been rioted and they've both been looted. Okay. But also, I mean, Clapham Junction was where a lot of people came out to help, so that was good.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Well, it's time to wrap it up. Summer's ending, and so is this series, so we got one more to go before we end it all. And Simon, who are we going to talk about to close off the big show?
Well, it's going to be a director who I've had to watch a lot of films, which I've been meaning to watch for a long time. So I'm really happy to discuss this guy. It is no other than Roman Polanski.
Roman Polanski was born in Paris in 1933. At the age of three, Polanski moved with his family to his father's native city of Krakow in Poland. A true survivor, his parents were imprisoned in various Nazi concentration camps, where his mother eventually died in Auschwitz. Polanski lived with several different Polish families until he was reunited with his father in 1944. As a teenager, Polanski was interested in acting, developing his acting skills in radio dramas and films. In 1954, he enrolled at the Polish National Film Academy, where he created short films and documentaries. Famed Polish director Andrzej Wajda cast him in many of his films, including Lotna in 1959 and Innocent Sorceress in 1960. 2 years later, he directed his first feature film, Knife in the Water. The international recognition that followed, including an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Film, gave Polanski the chance to bring his movies to a more mainstream audience. The following year, he moved to London, where his next offering, the psychological thriller Repulsion, was considered equally compelling by critics and audiences. 1968 saw Polanski move to Hollywood. His American film debut was the classic thriller Rosemary's Baby. But shortly after Rosemary's Baby, tragedy struck. His pregnant wife, actress Sharon Tate, was brutally murdered by members of the Charles Manson cult. Now, the extreme violence Polanski has been directly affected by is reflected in his films. The idea of alienation and evil came to the forefront of his acclaimed classic, Chinatown, in 1974. But these horrors did not end there. In 1977, Polanski was indicted on 6 criminal counts for having sexual relations with a minor. The alleged act took place with a 13-year-old girl in the home of the actor Jack Nicholson. Controversially, both Nicholson and his longtime girlfriend, actress Angelica Houston, testified against Polanski. In the end, Polanski pleaded guilty to one charge of unlawful sexual intercourse and underwent 6 weeks of psychiatric evaluation at a state prison in California. To make matters worse, Polanski fled the United States after he was discharged. He then traveled to Europe, settling in Paris, where he directed the critically acclaimed film Tess, an adaptation of Thomas Hardy's novel Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And then, throughout the 1980s, he concentrated on stage acting. 2002 saw his comeback when he directed The Pianist. He won the Palme d'Or and earned him a Best Director Oscar. But, unfortunately, Oliver Twist did not make much money, and The Ghostwriter, though critically well-received, it only made a gross of $15 million, as the production cost $45 million. He isn't everyone's cup of tea, and he is often cited as a director people will not watch out of principle. But he is nevertheless an auteur, with films that actively show the more pessimistic reality of the world, something that we all need to face from time to time.
All right, Simon, so you've said that you had to do a lot of research on Polanski, but when did you first become aware of Polanski and his work?
I read Sid Field's, How to Write a Screenplay, or one of his screenplay books, and one of the screenplays which he goes into a lot of depth about is Chinatown. That was when I think I realised how important Chinatown as a film is. But, I mean, to be honest, I think Roman Polanski is one of those directors which, when you read Easy Rider's Raging Bull, you always hear about Polanski at that point. He obviously was a very controversial figure way back in the 60s, and at the same time, you know, he obviously had that huge rape case in the 70s as well. So he's always been, I think, always known, maybe not necessarily for his films as much as for his controversial, his life.
Yeah, he's a name that's got some notoriety to it because of more, you know, just as much because of his life as because of his work.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. But then I think at the same time, you know, the films which, you know, which we'll get a chance to discuss, I mean, some of them are really some of the best films at the moment coming out.
Yeah, that's for sure. Going through a lot of his filmography this week, I was taken with how much I liked his work. I'd seen one or two of his movies in the past, but like you, there's no coincidence that we left him till last. We both had to do a lot of studying up for this episode. As I went through a lot of his work, I was really, really taken with just how talented he is.
There's some themes which he consistently seems to utilize. There's some interesting kind of concepts and ideas which he constantly kind of revisits. And I think, you know, so you have this element of auteur direction as well, but at the same time, these films are engaging, they're interesting, and they're definitely well worth watching.
Now, do you remember the first film of his that you ever saw, and when, and how, and whatnot?
The first film of his which I ever saw, I think, was Chinatown. Yeah.
And when was that?
Probably when I first started really obsessing about film, and, you know, probably about 2005, maybe.
Oh, okay. So again, rather recently.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, you know, and that was when I realized Chinatown is like one of the 10 most important films of cinema to watch.
Oh, okay. I first came across him in Chinatown was my first experience with him as well, and that would have been around 99, 2000 when I started getting seriously into film. But the first time I kind of knew about him proper and went in knowing what I was getting into would have been around 2002. I saw The Pianist in the theater.
Okay.
And of course that was the film that won him an Oscar for Best Director, and it really, really did just shake the living hell out of me. It was quite a movie and quite a bit of directing. It's not really a coincidence that he won Best Director for it.
Yeah, no, and The Pianist, you know, is quite a unique film. I mean, I always think it's like, you know, if you think Schindler's List is bad, I mean, watch The Pianist and it's even worse, you know, to see how graphic and how horrendous, really, the whole Holocaust obviously was.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There's not much love, put it that way.
No, there's not. And the particular story of the Holocaust that he wants to tell, it's 10 years or so after Schindler's List, so most filmgoers had an idea of what they were getting into, but he didn't want to do a rehash of Schindler's List. There were other films around the same time. I'm thinking of movies like The Gray Zone that was set in a concentration camp as well. And he didn't want to focus on that. He wanted to focus on the fact that that the Holocaust just tore up entire cities, and not only that, but it took what were at the time upper class families and reduced them down to their survival instincts, and it's really, really an amazing angle to take. So yeah, to see that in the theater, it was just really, really moving.
Yeah, I think we'll get more back into the themes and the ideas behind The Pianist, which we think kind of relate to Polanski's work. But I think, do you think maybe now's a good time to move on to our main feature?
I think now's as good a time as any. What have we chosen for the main feature, Simon?
It is no other than Chinatown from 1974.
Mr. Gittes?
Yes.
Do you know me?
Well, I think I would have remembered.
Have we ever met?
Well, no.
Never?
Never.
That's what I thought. You see, I'm Mrs. Evelyn Mulray. You know Mr. Mulray's wife?
Not, that Mulray.
Yes, Mr. Gittes, that Mulray. And since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I see you like publicity, Mr. Gittes. Well, you're going to get it.
Now, wait a minute, Mrs. Mulray. I think there's been some misunderstanding here. There's no point in getting tough with me.
Don't get tough with anyone, Mr. Gittes. My lawyer does.
Okay, Chinatown from 1974, American classic, modern film noir, if there ever was one. And it is the story of Jake Gittes and how he gets a little bit too nosy. And we find out what happens when men get too nosy. Simon, what'd you think of Chinatown?
I love it. I've seen it a few times now. It is definitely Polanski's masterpiece out of all his films. I think there's something tonally which is just so perfect about it in terms of the story. So tragic, and yet it deals with this very personal family situation at the same time as dealing with this huge, grand, you know, business side of things and something which reflects on the world at large. I do love the film. I think it's great. And Jack Nicholson's performance is flawless.
Well, it does a really, really amazing job of taking a genre that was, I don't want to say by 74 it was left for dead, but it wasn't really being made that often anymore in the film noir, and dusting it off and giving it some new life, right?
The way, I mean, I think he came to this, we've got to put some context around Polanski himself as well. I mean, this is a very pessimistic film.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, and film noir often has got that element of pessimism. It's down, it's dirty. Dealing with this.
That's
and
right.
you can see that, and you can feel it in the film itself. And it's so tragic how the whole film plays out.
Well, it's funny because that pessimism that you talk about, not to give too much away, but it's encapsulated in the film's final line of "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." It's the pessimism of the world of leave it alone. What can you do? There's nothing to be fixed here, so let's just go home.
Exactly. The whole idea of Chinatown. I mean, it's brilliant how they encapsulate this, because this is, you know, we understand as we watch the film that Jake previously worked there. It's his past. It's a past which he wants to forget, but it inevitably, potentially inevitably, it catches up with him. And that's something, again, which is fed into this story. So on the one side, you've got the idea that, you know, that there's, like you said, those iconic lines at the end, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." Same time, it's something which he has to acknowledge and he has to face, as it were, because it's something which is part of his past and it's caught up with him. That's fascinating.
Now, we have the grand part of the story, which is Los Angeles when it's being built and really, really booming in the 1930s. And how water enters into that. And it's an interesting spin on the story because, of course, it focuses on the lifeblood of this new city. Underneath all of that, it's being manipulated by these people who have this almost a soap opera going on in between them.
Well, obviously, we don't see the story played out from that angle at all. But we see it from this kind of this outsider in Jake Gittes, who's kind of called in. He's a guy who's just, he does his job, you know what I mean, on day to day, and he's kind of brought into this bit by bit.
and everything that he's finding out secondhand. We're never really privy to the goings-on of Hollis Mulray and why he disagrees with Noah Cross and what that has to do with Evelyn Mulray. We're finding it out the same way that Jake is finding it out, all of it secondhand and through, like, circumstance.
Yeah, and it's also a point that, you know, it doesn't, those details don't really matter. It's the ramifications and it's the consequence of these actions, the actions of greed.
Well, I think those details matter a little bit. Certainly what Evelyn and Noah have going on, I think that those details matter a great big deal, given how powerful a man Noah Cross is.
That's something which is from the past, which is inevitably caught up with Noah Cross. I mean, that's something which he cannot ignore. But in terms of the business side of things, in terms of the kind of the financial benefits which they have, how that comes about, the details as to how he's trying to screw over people financially with these money situations, how that's happening, ultimately it's a simple case of somebody in a position of power screwing over the little guy. That's something which you see a lot of, because you also get that in, you know, how all the figures of authority seem to be against the man, as in Jake.
Yeah. You know
what I mean? Not only is it Noah Cross, but it's also the superiors in the actual police department as well.
That's the funny thing, is in this story, this isn't just a straight cops and robbers story. This is a man who's operating outside of the system entirely, right? He's a private investigator. This isn't good guys and bad guys. This is kind of various levels of bad guys. He's a shady guy, Jake is. He's not exactly, like, he makes his plea of, I'm just trying to make a living and I'm just trying to do this and that. But he gets paid to snoop around in people's affairs, right? Nobody's innocent. And in this story, there really are no good guys. There are better people than some, but there's no hero.
And now we get to the kind of very personal nature of the film, which is the identity. And who is Jake, and who are these people, and where do they come from?
We get that almost directly off the top of the story, because the question, we start with a question of the identity of Evelyn Mulray. We meet a woman who poses herself to be Evelyn Mulray and start Jake down this road, and then it turns out that wasn't Evelyn Mulray at all. And even when we think we meet the real Evelyn Mulray, there's still things to her identity that she's hiding.
And the same with Jake Giddies, in that, you know what I mean, as we, with him as a character, I mean, his motives completely change after, you know, his face has changed, after his physical identity has changed by Roman Polanski himself.
Yep.
You know, his motives change as well.
It's a really intense film. Let's talk about Noah Cross for a second. John Huston as... he's almost a bully, Noah Cross is, a man who wants to, you know, he's got the classic motivation of money and power. And the one thing that I always loved about the character of Noah Cross is, you notice how he can't get Jake's name right? He always calls him Mr. Gitz.
Yes.
That, to me, always struck me as a rich person not caring. As somebody who is rich and powerful, who doesn't have 10 seconds to learn a person's name. And it just rubs you, and I'm sure it would rub Jake wrong every time he hears it mispronounced. Like, have you ever had somebody mispronounce your name?
Well, yeah, of course. My name's Colin.
And now think about that feeling of, you know, you want to tell them it's Colin, not whatever it is they're pronouncing. But Jake just never does. Jake never corrects him. That's gotta eat at him. But the thing is that Noah Cross is the kind of guy who wouldn't care. Even if you did correct him, he'd probably still go back to calling him Gitz in 10 seconds. Of course, the big turn, and we're assuming here that you've seen Chinatown. If you haven't, for the love of God, stop this podcast and just go watch Chinatown now.
Because we'll ruin Chinatown now.
Yes, we will. The big turn, of course, is that Cross and Mulray had a relationship, and that Cross is, in fact, Mulray's father. And that a child was born from that, which then becomes Evelyn Mulray's sister and daughter. For a mainstream American film, this is a very, very twisted turn.
This, I think, is where it kind of goes from, you know, a very good film to an outstanding film. In that this the whole idea of, you know, this incest, the nature of incest in itself is at the center of this whole corruption, as it were. is absolutely terrifying and fascinating. So even in the top end of the upper class, there is a concern in terms of nepotism, in terms of people employing others, you know what I mean, who are from their family, and the idea of they ultimately keep it within the family. And there's no more clearer way to demonstrate that by showing that in this story with Noah Cross.
Up until that point, Faye Dunaway, who is amazing as Evelyn Mulray in this film, through almost everything we've seen up until that point, she's kept it together. Even when she first confronts Jake Giddies for dragging her husband through the muck unnecessarily, she's always very composed, very poised. But when the truth about this comes out, when Jake is able to finally, get a handle on what's going on, we see her become unhinged in a great big hurry.
You also realize that Noah Cross, he's not sorry.
No.
His arrogance is that he actually thinks he has a right to all of this, that it doesn't matter. He has that much power. He can actually do this. He can commit incest. He's got that much power. He can do what he wants. And he doesn't care.
No.
And more importantly, that's how the film ends.
Yeah.
It's so, so shocking to see, but it's just something which says how incredible a director Polanski is, how incredible a writer Robert Towne is, and it really is brilliant.
It's kind of funny because if you recall when we talked about Seven, we talked about the fact that it ends on such a downer and how sometimes we talk about wanting the downer ending, and then when we get it, we don't know how to handle it. Well, in many respects, Chinatown does that as well. We get this absolute gut shot of a nihilistic ending, and it walks away, and it leaves us there kind of, heaving in the gutter, and gives us nothing to go with after the fact. So, we always say, people like you and I, we always say we want the true ending, or we don't want the happy ending. We want to end on a down note. But films like Chinatown are reminders why maybe that's not a good thing. All right, let's move on. We'll talk about more Polanski after this. So that's Chinatown. Now, Polanski has quite a long filmography. I don't know about you, Simon, but when it came time to really dive into his work, I wasn't entirely sure where to start. I actually need to send a quick word of thanks. Andrew James, who runs the Row 3 Cinecast, he's a big fan of Polanski. So when we set out to do this episode, I actually emailed him saying, buddy, where do I start? And he gave me a list of films to make sure that I had seen. And that really, really proved very handy because a lot of what I saw is the essential Polanski. There are others, of course, that I did not see that I'm sure are still very good. But for me to understand him as a director and understand his career, I had to see these 10 films or thereabouts. So thank you, Andrew. And so you said you've seen about half a dozen of his films in preparation for this episode?
I've seen The Ghost, and I've just recently watched The Ninth Gate.
Yeah, Ghost Rider, the thing I love about that, I was actually talking about this, about Ghost Rider at the DVD shop I go to get all these films that we talk about. It shows that Polanski's not coasting on legacy. You get some of these prestige directors, and I'm specifically talking about somebody like Francis Ford Coppola, who has not made a great film in a long time. At this point, he's going on his name. It's the same thing as George Lucas. By and large, he's going on his name. But then you get somebody like Polanski, who not every single one of his films was a complete winner. I'll grant you that. There's some of the stuff that I watched and some of the stuff that I just completely skipped that I wasn't crazy about. The thing that I like about The Ghost Rider is that it shows that he's still able to make a great film.
Yeah, and I think having discussed Chinatown, there's some really interesting parallels, I think, between the two. I mean, I think in a similar way, you have this idea of the cover-up, you have this kind of death at the center of it all, the idea of power. I mean, these are very, and a very pessimistic ending. These are similar in tone and themes to Chinatown.
I would actually go so far as to say that The Ghost Rider has one of the greatest endings I have ever seen.
I don't know about the greatest.
Oh, come on. That final scene when he's at the book launch, from the moment he goes into that back room, that is a clinic in filmmaking, in editing, and in style. I would put that up as one of the very, very best I've ever seen.
it's pretty incredible. I mean, it, visually, it looks stunning. But again, I think it works well because the whole film has this kind of expressionistic quality to it. In that, you know, you have the kind of, you know, when you see the Langs kind of, you know, secluded house. I mean, it's all rocky and the waves are crashing and the rain and the weather's just sort of windy and it's just like, it's so disorientating, which is obviously how the ghostwriter played by Ewan McGregor, you know, feels when he's, you know, doing the case. I mean, I think that that's a really great side to it.
The other thing the gentleman who runs my little DVD shop pointed out that is very true, and I noticed this as I was watching Polanski films, is he does an amazing job of telling stories where the protagonist doesn't realize they're in the soup until they're about waist deep in it.
Yeah, now you've said that, definitely. Yeah. I mean, everything, Chinatown, even The Pianist, I guess, to some extent, Rosemary's Baby.
The Ghostwriter.
And The Ninth Gate, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, now, they're not all bread and roses. Like, I watched Frantic, I didn't much care for that. And he's got, we're going to talk about one of the films in his apartment trilogy. The apartment trilogy being Repulsion, The Tenant, and Rosemary's Baby. Repulsion is a weird movie, which I don't think you saw.
No, I didn't.
It's very, very twisted. It almost looks like something out of the French New Wave. It's played by Catherine Deneuve, and she's living in a flat. She's got this kind of isolation going on, but she's also... She's slightly sexually enticed. So she's got all these visions going on in her head about what she wants and what she thinks about, but they're played out. The visions in her head were made to feel as though they're happening.
All right.
So yeah. So it's quite a movie. As I say, it's very, very much of its time. It shows the marriage of him being an experimental director and him giving something with this narrative of a person being in over their head. Now that said, so it's, I dug it. I don't know if I'd like buy it or anything like that. That said, The Tenant, the second part of the third part of the apartment trilogy is absolutely stellar. The Tenant is, it stars Polanski himself
as the lead role.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the lead actor, and he goes to this apartment building in Paris where he wants to become a new tenant, and he starts going crazy. He believes that every one of his other neighbors is out to get him because the previous tenant in his apartment went crazy and killed herself, so he starts to think that it's happening to him.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. And the way that he goes crazy, it's so spectacularly fun. It's great. Definitely check it out. Even though, you know, we're done talking for the show and everything, definitely check it out because you will. It could make for a classic column. Well, let's go to the top shelf of the locker because we could talk about Polanski all day. And I didn't even get into Death and the Maiden, which, by the way, is a very, very underrated film. But what's your choice off the top shelf if somebody wanted to get deeper into Polanski?
Well, I'm going to go back to The Pianist. I felt, when I watched it, in comparison to the other four, it seems to sit a little bit differently. It's based on a true story. It's about the pianist Spielman, a Jewish-Polish pianist, who him and his family were obviously, you know, during Nazi rule in Poland, his family were taken away to, you know, concentration camps and killed in the process. They were never found, actually. Yet he, on the other hand, hid out in Warsaw. And it's a fascinating story. And obviously Polanski's creation of this on cinema screen is absolutely fascinating. You've got a character who is so real. Often when we watch films, I think you're watching characters who you're kind of like, well, that's not really me. That's not really the type of thing I would do. Well, I think with The Pianist, what makes it so engaging is that this is not a superhero guy at the center of it. It's not a guy who gets through the Holocaust and through World War II through, you know, superior knowledge or power or anything. It is somebody who gets through pretty much through luck and the help of people who for some reason or not or other help him.
It's a combination of you know, intelligence and knowing what he can and can't get away with, and like you say, a lot of really, really lucky bounces.
Roger Ebert made a really good point, and I'm going to paraphrase that because I don't know off by heart the quote, but it was along the lines of the fact that Spielman is a survivor through luck and the help of non-Jews, and that's quite similar to Polanski himself. I mean, not only did Polanski himself survive World War II and survived, you know, being a Jew in Poland. And, I mean, his mother even was taken to a concentration camp and she died there. Roman Polanski himself also, you know, he survived the trauma in 1969, the murder of his wife. He survived, you know, he's still hanging on there, making films, I assume something he loves, despite a rape case against him in 1977. And, you know, and yet he seems to still survive through all these different things. And he doesn't need... there's no reason he should have.
Yeah.
He just has.
The Pianist is a very daring film because you got a lot of things. First of all, you have very, despite it being called The Pianist, you have very little music. There are long stretches that play out in silence, and much of the music either plays out on its own, if we see Spielman playing piano or if we see somebody playing a violin or something, or it happens in Spielman's head. And not only that, but of course we go much of the final 40 minutes of the film just resting on Adrian Brody trying to survive, running here and there around an increasingly destroyed Warsaw. Like, the great little trope that they keep coming back to is there's a statue that kind of stands guard over Warsaw, and we come back to her, it's a woman with her hand up, and we keep coming back to her, like, when the Nazis are rolling through or when the Jews are leaving, or at one point we come back to her and she's gone, like she's been destroyed by some sort of mortar and she's actually in pieces on the ground. It's such a wonderful film. Not wonderful in terms of heartwarming or anything like that, because it's very much a bummer of a film.
The one thing Polanski did very carefully with this film was try and make it as accurate as possible. One thing, you know, which he did do is reference actual newspaper articles, which were actually printed in Poland at the time. And they're, you know, when you hear them, you know, when you hear them read them out, you know, you're like, well, that's incredible that they had to publish that. You know, that Jews are being taken to a segregated area of Warsaw. And reading those actual newspaper articles is quite fascinating. And I think it's a good point to kind of reference how, you know, writing and articles and literature often is a feature of Polanski's work. I mean, even going so far as going back to Rosemary's Baby, where it's text and the literature of the devil or whatnot. You know what I mean? That's something which is an important point there. And obviously The Ghostwriter is about a guy writing a book. The Ninth Gate is obviously it's about a book, a guy who searches and looks for books. So, interesting to see how, you know, that use of text and how text is so impactful. I think is so great. And I think in The Pianist, it's funny because those actual newspaper articles, by them reading them out, it is so much more impactful than if they just said, this is happening, and then showed a picture of it. In the case of this film, because it's based on reality, you know, reading those actual articles is horrific.
Now, for me, my top shelf pick is Rosemary's Baby, and this was really Polanski's arrival on the big time. This film goes back to 1968. This is before the murder of his wife. This is obviously before his legal troubles. It's amazing to watch in terms of a time capsule perspective, because on its surface, it's about a woman who is pregnant and gives birth to the spawn of Satan. I'm not going to try and hide that or anything. If you haven't seen Rosemary's Baby or you don't know, sorry. But she gives birth to Satan's child. But if this film were to be made now, If that story were to be told in the new century, I imagine that it would be much flashier. I imagine that they'd really, really try to up the production of it and the effects and everything, and have Rosemary, played here very, very well by Mia Farrow, have her get more manic. But the fact that it's all so subtle, that it's a woman who knows something is wrong. Something is wrong with her body. Something is wrong with the situation. And she can't get anybody to listen to her. That concept is terrifying. You consider what's at stake when a woman is pregnant anyway. Like, every little hiccup, you know, is sometimes cause for concern. And I don't mean to say that flippantly. I mean it because there's a lot at stake in terms of health. You take that situation and you get it to a point where a woman knows something is genuinely not right. And nobody wants to listen to her despite, you know, basically begging. It's really terrifying.
It's so sinister. That's what, I mean, the older couple next door are just, oh my God, they're so sinister, and there's something about it, and they're all flattering, and oh, you're a great actor, you know, you're, oh my gosh, and blah, 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 blah. But there's just something there, and I think it's fascinating because you can very easily see that happening, because they don't come across as that aggressive, and you're generally going to try and be nice and be civil, and yet this couple just get under your skin bit by bit by bit, and that in itself is a fascinating thing to do. And also, you know, the idea of that evil being in your own home and yet you being powerless to do anything about it is equally as fascinating.
He really goes off the rails at one point, and he doesn't even really go that far off the rails, but during the scene where we're led to believe that the Satan child has been conceived, it's a really little twisted scene in a 1960s kind of way. I imagine, again, I said before, if this film were to be made now, I imagine that scene would go to even further extremes. But by and large, the rest of it is kept very, very subtle. And it's that subtlety that makes it all the more terrifying. There's a scene where she's on the phone with who she hopes will be a new doctor to help her out. And you watch this scene, and you can kind of see this desperation in her eyes. Mia Farrow's got these great eyes in this film, because she's got that short pixie haircut, and she's got, like, eyes the size of garage doors. And at this point, she's almost at the end of her tether. You know, she's in the phone booth. And behind her, you see somebody walking up and standing and kind of milling there. And we don't know who this person is. We don't know what effect they have. But we've got this terror that this is somebody involved in the situation, and this is somebody who's going to do her harm. And it's the subtlest move, but it's so good.
No, you're so right. That type of subtlety is great. And, you know, going back to those dream sequences, I think Rosemary's Baby and those dream sequences in that goes very well with the kind of the drug sequences in Easy Rider and the hip and the sequences in Midnight Cowboy, and both of them obviously released in 69. And so you can see at this time these filmmakers were just trying out all these different types of editing procedures to show people just going nuts and showing this kind of craziness. But yeah, and Mia Farrow especially, her whole presence. There's that one bit when I think it is her friend kind of comes round, this older guy who for a long time I thought was her dad, but I don't think it is. But he came round, and she just looks so ill, and she's like, oh, I'm fine, oh, it's great. And you're just like, oh, my God, you look horrible, woman. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And it's, again, it's just that subtlety, you know what I mean? Nothing, it's just her makeup.
Yeah.
And that's it. And yet you feel like, oh, my God, this is horrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrible.
The one thing I will say, like, this was a film that was actually suggested to me last year when I was looking for horror films to watch that I had never watched. This was a film that was suggested to me. And I'll leave it on this note. I can think of fewer, more twisted and eerie things that I have seen in the film than just somebody saying he has his father's eyes.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's about enough about Polanski. We'll come back right after this with the trivia and the wrap up. Well, that's Polanski. That sets us up quite nicely for a film he's got coming out this year called Carnage. We'll see if maybe he can build on what he was able to do with The Ghost Rider, or if he's going to take a step back. But let's give away a DVD, Simon. It looks very much like Rachel Thoreau has this in hand. But stranger things have happened. There's still an outside chance that somebody else could take it from her, so let's make her earn her supper. Why don't you get us started? What are your three questions?
Okay, the first question for me is, there are four actors that Roman Polanski has got Oscar-nominated performances from. One of them is Jack Nicholson. Another one's Faye Dunaway. Another one's Adrian Brody. Who's the fourth? My second question is, he has not been back to the US since which year? And which of the following films has Roman Polanski acted in? Is it Rush Hour, Rush Hour 2, or Rush Hour 3?
Okay. My three questions go like so. Pierce Brosnan's character in The Ghost Rider is based on which public figure? The second question is for you to name all three films in Polanski's Apartment trilogy. Final question concerns Rosemary's Baby. I want to know who was dating Mia Farrow during the filming of the movie tried to get her to quit, and ultimately dumped her because she wouldn't. Email your answers, filmlocker@hotmail.com, and you have a chance to win a DVD or Blu-ray if you are faster than Rachel Thoreau. Well, that's just about it, buddy. It's been a pretty good summer doing this series with you.
Yeah, well, you know, those last three episodes with Guillermo del Toro and Roman Polanski, yeah, they've really made me watch some films which I'm so happy to have seen, you know, Hellboy and Rosemary's Baby. You know, these are films which I always hear people go on about, so I'm so glad I've actually managed to watch them now.
Well, I'd even go further and say that, I got that kind of feeling as well with Ang Lee. Like, when I saw films like The Wedding Banquet, I was really, really quite taken with that kind of thing.
You watched A Life Less Ordinary, and
yeah, that one didn't do quite as much for me. But by that same token, I did watch Shallow Grave for this show, so that more than made up for it. I did a blog post about this where I talked about this summer having so much of the movies I watched be for a purpose, and how I had to try and find a balance between watching what I wanted to watch and watching something because of a project. And ultimately, most of what I watched for this project, I'm happy that I had that on a pick list.
Well, I've actually got, I mean, not only that for me, I've actually got films which I didn't get round to watching sitting at the sides, including Crimes and Misdemeanors, Devil's Backbone, and and Ride with the Devil,
we'll look forward to you writing about those for sure. We should tell listeners we are intending to record a series 2. We don't know just yet when it will be, although we know that we do want to do it. So just kind of keep your eyes open. It'll be a few months for sure. We both need a little bit of a chance to rest and see some other movies that aren't assigned. But this isn't the end of the Film Locker. We will do a series 2 that will be equally self-contained, and we hope to have you back then.
Yeah, not to mention, it gives you time to catch up. If there are any episodes which you haven't managed to watch the main film from, do it
yeah,
now.
There we go. And one other last little thing, we would hope, if you've liked what we've done this summer, if you've enjoyed these 12 episodes, do tell people about it. Part of the reason why the series was so short and the episodes were shorter is because we wanted it to work as one series, so that people could come back to it kind of the same way that you go to, a BBC show or an HBO show that's got a shorter season, and it makes for better re-listening in this case.
And now is also the time to write a review on iTunes regarding it. Now we've done all 12 episodes, you can really criticize it and rate us on iTunes. That'd be great too.
I'm almost afraid of what people are going to write. Well, keep your eye on the blog. We'll update that periodically in the next few months. A lot of these directors we've talked about have films coming up, certainly Scorsese, and as we mentioned, Polanski and Almodovar, they all have films coming up, so we'll try and cross-post some of our work onto the blog, and of course, when we do decide to do Series 2, we'll update that as well.
Okay. It's been great, Hunter.
It has. I'm going to miss you, man, although I won't miss... I'll certainly enjoy getting some sleep on a Sunday morning.
That's going to be true, I know. Yeah. Well, I think we have to swap it around, so I'm doing the shift at 1 a.m. in the morning or something.
I like it. I'm all over that. All right, well, in Toronto, Canada, I'm the Mad Hatter.
And from London in England, where there are no riots at the moment, this is Simon Colum.
Thanks for listening, and take care.